Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From frontiersin.org, we have a piece from Dr. Vladimir Donets, a zoologist who studies animal behavior, ecology, and conservation, that outlines how a Cooper's hawk learned to use traffic signals to hunt more successfully.
Oh, he's not just like, let me avoid the traffic and not die. He's like, I will use this to murder other animals.
Yeah, effectively. Okay. This is wild. So the Cooper's hawk, if you live in Austin, you probably have heard them. They sound kind of like demented seagulls, but we're not anywhere near the sea.
That's why they're demented. The sea calls to them and they can't get there.
Well, and they're not seagulls. They're definitely raptors. I mean, they're beautiful, silent, and also they come up pretty close. Like they hang out on telephone poles and they've caused a bit of a disturbance in the Travis Heights neighborhood. There's a great local news piece about that you could probably find online. But basically, the Cooper's hawk is a medium-sized raptor. It's native to North America, and it appears to have learned how to adapt its hunting strategy and strike at a flock of birds precisely when cars at an intersection lined up after traffic lights switched to red, having been alerted by a sound signal that the red phase would last longer than usual. So let's paint the scene here.
Yeah.
So it's not a really particularly busy intersection. Even during morning rush hour, when this author was driving their daughter to work, there were usually only a few cars waiting for the green light. But when a pedestrian pressed a button, which caused the red light to last a lot longer, the line of cars became longer as well, sometimes stretching all the way to a small street side tree with a particularly dense crown. And when that happened, the street light makes a sound signal because pedestrians crossing, they usually let blind people know that it's safe to cross, right? So one winter morning, the author is waiting in their car, waiting for the light to change, and suddenly sees a Cooper's hawk. It emerged from that small tree, flew very low along the side of cars, made a sharp turn, crossed the street between the cars, and dove onto something near one of the houses. Turns out that the house targeted by the hawk's attacks was inhabited by a nice big family that liked to eat dinner in the front yard. So in the morning following these dinners, their breadcrumbs and other leftovers on the lawn would attract a small flock of birds, like sparrows, doves, sometimes even starlings. And that is the Cooper hawk's meal. So what was really interesting and took the author a while to figure out was that the hawk always attacked when the car queue was long enough to provide cover all the way to the small tree. And that only happened after someone had pressed the pedestrian crossing button.
Huh.
As soon as the sound signal was activated, the raptor would fly from somewhere into the small tree, wait for the cars to line up, and then strike. Which means the bird also had to have a really good mental map of the place, because once the car line got long enough to the tree, the raptor no longer had visibility of the place where its prey was and had to get there by memory. And what's even more intriguing to the author, the bird in question was a juvenile.
Mm.
Now, Cooper's hawks rarely nest in cities in this author's area, but they're common winter visitors. So the bird the author was watching was almost certainly a migrant, having moved to this city just a few weeks earlier, and yet it already had figured out how to use traffic signals and patterns.
I mean, it could be the Einstein of the Cooper hawks. Like, we, you know...
Now, the following summer, the sound signal at the street light stopped working. And the residents of that, you know, feasting house, they moved out. So there were no more bird flocks. And the author had not seen any Cooper's hawks around there since.
Aww.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other thing. If the pedestrian sound alarm has stopped working, now you're going to get blind people getting hit by cars. That's just for the carrion birds. Like, it's
oh, no.
A different species.
Oh no. Oh, no. The food chain cannot disrupt that much that quickly.
Okay.
We've got enough going on this year. All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from elpais.com. It's titled, A Robotic Arm Made from Human Tissue. Science Advances Toward Living Muscle Prosthetics. Yeah. So the goal sounds like science fiction, to create a prosthetic that moves like a natural part of the body, but it's a developing line of research in bioengineering. In February, the University of Tokyo, in collaboration with Waseda University, created an 18-centimeter arm from human muscle tissue capable of moving its fingers. Professor Masaharu Takeuchi notes that the hand developed by his team is the largest of its kind ever built in a lab. The professor explains that the greatest challenge was generating enough force from the muscles to move the hand. That requires more muscle mass, but if the tissue is too thick, nutrients and oxygen can't reach all the cells, causing them to die. Hmm. The solution was to roll thin sheets of muscle tissue like sushi rolls and assemble them into a more complex multi-joint structure the researchers have named MUMUTAS, short for multi-muscle tissue assemblies. These MUMUTAS were then integrated into a cable-driven robotic structure. When electricity is applied to the muscles, they contract and pull on the cables connected to the fingers, allowing them to bend, move, and grasp objects, similar to real tendons. Meanwhile, in Barcelona, the Institute for Bioengineering of Catalonia are exploring alternatives to this external electrical stimulation for the biological robots they're developing. Using sensors and electrodes integrated directly into the muscle, they have created more localized and controlled simulation systems. This approach not only allows for better emulation of how real muscles work, but also makes it possible to study muscle responses to drugs and other active compounds. That's from IBEC director Samuel Sanchez.
Bodybuilding will never be the same. Like, I'm picturing Krang from, is that his name? From, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja. Like, we can make these now. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yeah. Biohacking has been a thing for a hot minute, but very low level. Like, I know there was one guy who was experimenting with CRISPR. I forget his name, but he came up with a solution. I mean, this is totally experimental, where he injected himself with something to basically, like, increase his muscle mass and density. It's pretty intense.
Like the guys in Russia who, like, put juice in their arms and have Popeye biceps.
I'm not familiar with that, but...
Oh, I wouldn't Google it. Don't.
Okay, yeah. I mean, this is like he was changing his DNA, is the type of stuff he was doing. But the other crazy thing about this, too, is that Sanchez has this line, which I don't completely understand. It's not exactly explained in this article, but he says, putting your own cells in it and rebuilding your muscles. So I guess the idea is that your own cells could be compatible with the bioprinted arm.
Mm-hmm. So like trying to use them as if they were stem cells.
Yeah, I think so. Like it basically has the housing of the, I guess, the medium that is needed to support human life. And because it's not reactive or allergic to it, it's able to just become part of that muscle, which is kind of wild.
Wild. Yeah.
Yeah. So beyond the dream of a bionic prosthesis, bioengineering promises to revolutionize how medical and pharmaceutical testing is conducted. Instead of using animals, labs could rely on lab-printed human biological models, accelerating results and improving precision. And, you know, killing fewer mice. in the US, the FDA already allows, in some cases, skipping animal testing in favor of evaluating drugs with bioprinted tissue.
Right. And if you could bioprint my specific tissue, you could test those drugs...
For you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For me specifically, risk-free.
Oh, yeah. Too, think about with women. We could test things on women's tissues and bodies.
No, come on now. Let's be reasonable.
Yeah.
Anyway, next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from The Conversation. When Elvis and Ella were pressed onto X-rays, the subversive legacy of Soviet, quote, bone music.
I don't understand any of those words. What?
So we're going to back up in time a little bit. When Western Electric invented electrical sound recording about 100 years ago, it transformed our relationship to music. So before then, we were cutting mechanically. This was, you had the rolled paper on cylinder, or it was aluminum foil, and you were just yelling into a cone, which meant that the fidelity on it was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. Jump forward to 100 years ago, and we get electric microphones, and we could now capture with much higher fidelity. And for the first time, recorded sounds closely resembled what a live listener would hear-ish. And then we changed that, right? And then the Beatles are like, yeah, you're never going to hear this live. So over the ensuing years, sales of vinyl records and record players boomed. The technology also allowed some enterprising music fans to make recordings in surprising and innovative ways. As a physician and scholar in the mechanical humanities, the author was fascinated by the use of X-ray film to make recordings, what was known as bone music or ribs.
Just because literally it was X-rays and they were like, we associate these with bones.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because I'm imagining like carving something into bone. Like, I mean, there's a lot of things bone music could be and very few of them involved. Yeah. Like
QR code lasered onto bone that if you have the right X-ray will take you to their Spotify playlist.
Right. Or just, you know, Barry White. Like, this is what you play when you're...
Right. So... this came to be as a way to skirt censors in the Soviet Union. So at the end of World War II, Soviet censors shifted into high gear in an effort to suppress a Western culture deemed threatening or decadent. Punishments inflicted on Soviet artists and citizens for producing or disseminating censored materials include loss of employment, imprisonment in the gulags, or death. Today, X-rays are produced and stored digitally, but for most of the 20th century, they were created on photographic film and stored in large film libraries, which took up a lot of space. And because they can't be reused, hospitals often just recycled them to recoup the silver they contained. But in the Soviet Union in the 40s, some clever people realized that X-ray film was just soft enough to be etched into by the lathe or the recording device. To make a rib or bone recording, they would use a compass to trace out a circle on the exposed X-ray film that might bear an image of a patient's skull, spine, or hands. They'd then use scissors to cut out a circle before cutting a hole in the middle, and it would fit on a conventional record player. I've seen some of these in the past. Like, some punk bands did it in the 80s. The problem with the lathe on the X-ray is that the fidelity wasn't great. Like, it's not as good as a normal record. But the stylus that you could record this with could be obtained after hospitals threw them out or purchased at a pretty low price from hospitals. Again, the sound was poor, but who cares?
Right. If you're desperate for music, you'll do what you have to.
Yeah. And you can only play it a few times before it would just eat itself up.
Oh, okay. So you got to save it for the big raver. Like, don't waste it on listening by yourself.
Yeah. So this was, you know, again, dangerous. It's against the law. And the music itself suggested that a different sort of life is possible beyond the strictures of communist officials. How could a political system that prohibited beautiful music, many asked, possibly merit the allegiance of its citizens?
Fear?
Yes, exactly. Speaking of which, there's a video, just kind of a quick aside, of Billy Joel losing his mind on stage. I don't know if you've any of you have seen that. Oh, it's fantastic. Watch it. Like, he cusses, he screams, he throws his piano. Billy Joel throws his piano on stage. Well, the American company that was he went to the Soviet Union to record. He was one of the first to record in the Soviet Union, and he brought a film crew. And the film crew kept lighting the audience.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he was very angry at his own film crew for lighting the audience. Now, what's funny is the Russians just thought it was part of the show. So in subsequent performances, they want him to do that again and again. He's like, well, that's not really my bag.
Yeah. Like, the Billy Joel, he's wild and crazy, man.
UFC edition.
That's right.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got a video from Phil Edwards on YouTube called Why Every American Kid Sits on the Same Chair.
Oh.
So apologies in advance for our non-American listeners, because I don't know that this chair extends to any other part of the world. But if you went to school in America anytime between the 1960s and today, you have almost certainly sat on one of these chairs. And you might already know the chair I'm talking about, but it's a single piece of molded navy blue plastic with round stainless steel legs and three vertical openings in the lower back. And if my description's not doing it for you, just do an image search for school chair, because it is the number one result. So the name of this product, to my utter delight, is the Verco 9000.
That's way too high tech.
Exactly. And their parent company, Verco, says they have sold more than 60 million units to date. Which is even crazier when you remember that these things are basically indestructible. Like, I'm willing to bet there are still some original units from the 60s being used in schools today. I don't know if y'all ever tried to break one. I did, but I was a delinquent. So. So he goes a little into the history of school chairs, starting with the 1873 school seat released by a company called Patent Model, which used a brass frame layered with horizontal wooden slats. That was followed in 1881 by the classic A.H. Andrews and Company design that had a desk integrated into the back of the seat for the child behind you to use. This was again made of wood and iron and was extremely heavy, which was kind of a feature of all furniture back then. But there was a big shift starting in the 1920s when people suddenly realized that tubular steel, which was hollow and lightweight compared to other metals, didn't have to be exclusively an industrial product. And the most famous early example of tubular steel in furniture was the Wasilli chair, designed by Marcel Breuer in 1925. And that one's actually pretty strange looking, at least to my modern eye. Like, I would never guess that it came from the 20s. It's very boxy and sort of sunken, and it honestly resembles what I would think of as office furniture from the 60s. But, you know, Breuer was a very conceptual designer, so it was meant to look futuristic for its time. So then the video goes through a bunch of other early iterations of this sort of dramatic modernizing trend and chairs until we get to Charles and Ray Eames in the 1950s, who started using single-piece molded plastics in their chair designs. Shortly after that, a company called Haywood Wakefield introduced the first plastic chair into the school market, which they actually advertised as being made of Haywoodite, because at this point, not everybody had even heard of plastic yet.
Wow.
And so this is the moment when Verco, which had previously been known as U.S. Steel Plating, officially spun off its own furniture company to combine the tubular steel that they were already very familiar with and molded plastic. And their first advertising campaign used the slogan, "Plastic at the price of wood," because prior to this, plastic had actually been sort of a luxury material. So Verco chugged along for a little while in the furniture market until in 1965, they officially released their groundbreaking new product, the Verco 9000. And to understand why it was so perfectly timed for the era, we have to look at some changes that were happening in both America and the educational system at the time. First off, this is when the baby boomer generation hit their adolescence. And over the course of just 20 years, the number of school children in America nearly doubled, which I think we forget that boomers used to be young. But they all the way up through their whole age, like when they hit the workforce in their 20s and when they started having babies of their own, like they have been an effect throughout all of our known American history.
Ugh. Sorry. Yeah, we feel it. We know.
Yeah. Secondly, this is when the idea of so-called open education began to take off, where things like rigid rows of desks and forced memorization were replaced with a more flexible teaching style that allowed kids to pursue their own interests a little more, as well as break a classroom down into smaller groups with different skill levels. So to have this sort of flexible movement around the classroom, which, by the way, also helped cram more children into the classroom, you had to have lightweight, preferably stackable furniture. Which, okay, fine, but that still leaves us with the question, why this particular stackable chair? And it turns out Verco had a couple of unique advantages here. First, they have always made their products in America. And while that definitely put them at a disadvantage in the furniture market as a whole, it made them perfectly suited to the education market. Because a school doesn't know how many kids they're going to have enrolled until just before school starts. And overseas factories require a longer lead time on their orders. So for seasonal deliveries on short notice, having the factory based in America was really important. The other reason domestic production was critical is that school chairs, again, need to be indestructible, which means they come off the factory line in one solid piece, and they don't ship very efficiently compared to things that can be assembled at their destination. And the way shipping companies measure this is something called the price cube threshold, which is sort of a dollar amount by volume comparison that tells you whether a product is going to leave too much wasted space on a container ship. And school chairs definitely do. But the biggest factor in Verco's favor is that individual schools or even individual school districts don't usually place their own equipment orders. Purchasing for the education system in America is often done at the state or sometimes even national level. And they often use third-party negotiators who are authorized to sign massive bulk contracts as a form of collective price bargaining.
And that was their cousin.
Right, yes. Well, the potential for corruption is definitely there. But yeah, the flip side of that, if you're the manufacturer, is that once these negotiators do settle on a contract with you, you've cornered the market by default. Like, if you've sold one, you've sold 60 million, and there is no in-between. And I'll be honest, at this point, the video ends very strangely. There's suddenly this inspirational music track, and he starts talking about how nostalgia connects us to one another, and therefore this chair actually represents our shared humanity. It gets a little floofy. But, you know, it is true. I looked at a picture of this thing and went, oh my God, that's the chair. So, you know, maybe he's not wrong.
Was he at the very end a push to buy more chairs? Was that the...
I don't know. It was very weird. Honestly, it just felt like he didn't have a way to end it. He was like, so here's the information about the chair. And he's like, no, how can we make this meaningful? And there's a whole bit that he's doing where he's like leaning back and balancing on the two legs, which you can very much do in those chairs because the legs are spread so wide because they don't want children to fall out of their chairs. But children are determined to fall out of their chairs. So. Next link.
Next link.
All right. We're going to stay with the Utes and check out this article from The Guardian. But a California teenage girl who fended off an attacker by using jujitsu.
Nice.
Yeah, I've seen that movie. It's The Karate Kid, right?
That's right. Hilary Swank. Yeah. We're probably due for a remake based on a real life story. But here is the real life story. It's a 13-year-old California girl who is effectively reminding the public that knowing self-defense can save your life. After she reportedly used her martial arts training to fend off a stranger, breaking the grown man's ankle in the process. Yeah, I normally don't cheer, but yeah. Now, the girl, whose name has not been widely shared, recently had to fight to protect herself 3 years since she first began attending jiu-jitsu classes in Carmel, California. It's about 75 miles away from San Jose. Her jiu-jitsu instructor, Michael Blackburn, told the outlet that the teen was walking home from school on May 6th when a man she did not know stepped out from between two parked cars and tried, quote, to punch her in the face.
Oh.
The girl immediately turned to her training. Quote, she punched him, she got him in a headlock, kneed him a couple of times, spun him around, threw him on the ground. And she stepped on his foot doing all of this, and when she threw him to the ground, she broke his ankle. She managed to run home safely. Meanwhile, the assailant fled. Police were not immediately able to identify a suspect in the foiled attack and asked anyone in the quaint beach community with a population of about 3,100 people to come forward if they had any information, because you can't really hide in a town that small.
Well, and if you're limping like that, it's pretty easy.
Yeah. Local police said they're doing everything they can to figure out who this person is. They added that investigators surmise the man may have been under the influence of an intoxicant or, quote, dealing with some other personal issues. Blackburn, for his part, said it broke his heart that his student was forced to face down such danger, but he was grateful his student had mastered how to protect herself with jiu-jitsu. This is a Japanese style of weaponless fighting. It emphasizes subduing opponents with holds, throws, and paralyzing strikes. Quote, we're proud of her. She did exactly what she was supposed to do. You have to fight in class like you're going to protect yourself on the street. Meanwhile, though they were shocked that one of their own could endure such frightening circumstances, residents said they indeed found inspiration in the girl's bravery. Longtime Carmel resident Richard Cushman said, I think it was amazing what she did. It's fantastic. Oh, but it's horrible what happened.
Right.
All right, next link.
Next link.
I'm going to stay on the topic of hands today. This article comes to us from studyfinds.org. It's titled, This is What Really Creates the Sound When You Clap. And it's not skin slapping.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Disappointing.
I have a guess.
Yeah. Bradley probably already knows. Every time you applaud at a concert or celebrate a touchdown, your hands are performing a feat of physics that scientists have puzzled over for decades. Most people assume clapping sounds come from skin slapping against skin, but this breakthrough study published in Physical Review Research reveals that the sharp crack of applause actually works like a tiny musical instrument hidden in your palms. When you clap, you're creating what scientists call a Helmholtz resonator, which is the same principle that makes sound when you blow across a bottle opening.
Oh.
Yeah. And so every time you blow across the top of an empty bottle and you hear that low hollow tone, air moves in and out of the bottle's narrow opening, while the large cavity inside acts like an acoustic spring. Scientists have known about this effect for over 150 years, but nobody had properly studied how it applied to human clapping until now. The research involved 10 people between ages 18 and 70 performing different types of claps while sophisticated equipment recorded every detail using high-speed cameras, sensitive microphones, and pressure sensors. The opening between your thumb and index finger, called the pericue, acts as the narrow neck of the resonator, and as your hands collide, the trapped air gets compressed and shoots out through this opening like a tiny jet, creating the distinctive clapping sound.
Huh.
Well, I'm definitely going to use the word perlicue sometime this week.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was just, actually, we got some new cats, and I got scratched on my perlicue.
Nice.
So now I know how to refer to that. It's all better now, but it was annoying. So using baby powder to make airflow visible, scientists could actually see the jet of air blasting out from between people's hands at the moment of each clap. This jet moves at speeds between 13 and 90 meters per second, which is fast enough to be classified as turbulent flow. They concluded that the human hand clapping sound is generated neither by the solid material vibration post-collision nor by the jet turbulence, but by the Helmholtz resonance excited by the initial emergence of the jet at the neck of the hand-enclosed chamber. Different hand positions create different pitches, just like different sized bottles make different tones.
Mm.
And your hand claps are actually playing two instruments at once. Beyond the main air chamber effect, researchers found that the grooves between your fingers can also create sound, working like tiny organ pipes.
Wow. I want to play the organ pipe hand, like a harmonica without an instrument. Are you kidding me?
You have it attached to you. Go for it.
Yeah. So material properties matter, too. Softer hands create different sounds than firmer ones, not because of pitch changes, but because of how quickly the sound fades away. Softer tissue absorbs more acoustic energy, making claps sound more muffled and brief. Speed affects volume in a predictable way. The faster you clap, the higher the pressure builds in your palm cavity, and the louder the resulting sound. Scientists tested their theories using computer simulations and confirmed their resonator model could accurately predict clapping frequencies. They could even design artificial hands with specific cavity sizes and neck openings to produce claps at predetermined pitches. And then they can collaborate with the scientists from the last article I did and create bioengineered clapping instruments, which is, I don't know why, but you could.
Well, and that's the end of the Spanish musicians who do the clapping stuff.
Yeah.
Robots are taking their jobs.
Yeah. Listen, when you said we were going to stay with hands, I forgot you'd already done a hand article. I thought you meant the girl throwing hands.
Oh. Like I didn't. That too,
but what does a punch sound like? Like, that matters too. I bet a punch has a specific pitch
for
frequency.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm going to make a Helmholtz resonation against your face. So, yeah, this discovery has practical applications beyond satisfying scientific curiosity. Lead author Yikong Fu, a doctoral student at Cornell University, says architects use hand claps to test room acoustics because they provide a quick, consistent sound source. Understanding exactly how claps work could improve these measurements and might help develop better sound recognition systems or assist in music education programs that use rhythmic clapping.
I mean, the thing is, if it's as unique as your fingerprint, we're a step away from AI being able to hear you clap and know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
AI models that can pick you out in the middle of a standing ovation. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's like lighting the audience, but they're just listening to the claps.
Yeah.
Cool. Made it dark. All right.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right. From the Science Alert, who gets your digital remains when you die?
Oh.
Yeah. Digital legacies are increasingly complex and evolving. They include now familiar items such as your social media, bank accounts, along with our stored photos, videos, and messages, but they also encompass virtual currencies, behavioral tracking data, and even AI-generated avatars. This data reveals patterns in our preferences, passions. For example, knowing the music a loved one listened to on the day they died. All right, author. So, all of these raise practical and ethical questions about our identity, privacy, corporate power over our digital afterlives. Who has right to this access, right? Who can delete this? So in 2017, the author helped develop key recommendations for planning your digital legacy. They include creating an inventory of accounts and assets, recording usernames and login information, and if possible, downloading personal content for local storage. Specifying preferences in writing, noting wishes about what content should be preserved, deleted, or shared, and with whom. Using password managers. Designating a digital executor who has legal authority to carry out your digital legacy wishes and preferences, ideally with legal advice. And then using legacy features on some of these platforms, such as Facebook's Legacy Contact, Google's Inactive Account Manager, or Apple's Digital Legacy. Angie, I just sent you mine.
Yeah.
So yeah, it comes with a passcode that if I die, she has access to all of my, at least Apple stuff, can get on all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then do whatever she wants with it, because I haven't written anything
down. Guys, I'm still here. Hey.
I mean, knowing Angie, she's going to build an avatar and talk to you. I mean, surely she's way into that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had a little experience working adjacent to this where I've had opportunities to talk with companies where you can record messages and send them to your family from the grave on a schedule, which, you know, we were talking about it and it was like internally, we're like, this is a little weird potentially, but also as a business model, it's really difficult because these businesses just say like, we're going to be around for, you know, the next 100 years. We promise. Yeah. And financially, it just seems a very difficult business to run and keep viable. So yeah, it's a really tricky problem.
Good old pen and paper, man.
Yep.
If you want to write a letter to your kid after you're dead, just write it down. Yep. It works.
For me, I use a password manager, so I'm planning if something happens to have a contingency where it's like it's just the one password that gives access to everything to my loved ones, and that's how I could handle that. And you should have a password manager just in general. Highly recommend it.
Right. Fully aside from whether you're going to die, manage your passwords.
Yeah. Yes.
Truly.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include water ice found in another star system, the rise of the Japanese toilet, and when Canada's most famous brain surgeon almost killed his own sister. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.